Looks okay. So I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing together with Carlo Canali and Alexander Kohoven at the University of Lund. Part of this has been published. And this work was originally motivated by the experiments that were mentioned in the last talk, the first generation of which is done by Sophie Guérin in Dan Ralph's lab. And what this showed, this is what created my interest in the question of what goes on with the quantum states in a ferromagnetic metal that's small enough or that you can look at the individual quantum states in some way. And what this shows, I mean, as we've just heard in the last talk, the interpretation of these experimental data is probably more complicated than the naive interpretation that these are just excitation energies of ferromagnetic grains. But it shows that the physics on the evolution of these excitations with field on the scale of the anisotropy field of the grain is very complicated, as was mentioned in the last talk. And I think it's really new physics. And what I'm going to talk about is really not completely digested effort to start to think about that type of question. And some of what these types of experiments potentially can tell us about is also relevant, I believe, to thinking about current-driven magnetization reversal and similar issues that we heard about this morning, or at least what those what will happen to those types of things in still smaller systems. So let me just say a few words about different approaches that are used in different circumstances to talk about ferromagnetic metals. First of all, there is the stoner model, in which in a crystal, for example, you have energy bands that are split. There's an energy difference between upspins and downspins. So this is a microscopic model, focuses on individual quasiparticles. There's a very different type of model that's also very widely used and very useful, which is a classical model, micromagnetic model, in which a magnetic particle is described in terms of a classical degree of freedom, which is, say, the space dependence of the magnetization orientation and includes different contributions to the energy, including, importantly, magnetic dipole interactions and magnetocrystalline anisotropies and exchange terms. And so this type of model, let's say, is what you use to understand the behavior of magnetic media. But it's purely classical, and sometimes, or at least what we're interested in here, are situations where quantum physics is important. And where quantum physics of the collective degrees of freedom are important, people often use some sort of effective spin model. And I guess one of the things I'm going to be emphasizing is that that type of model is probably... Okay, thanks. Not a good model for metals, usually. And what I'm going to say is that when we look at a small magnetic particle at the individual quantum states, we have to combine these different approaches, which are all useful in different limits in I think, new kinds of ways. And that's the new physics that occurs in these systems. And so one of the things that I will emphasize throughout my talk is that there's a qualitative difference between, as far as the excitation spectrum is concerned, between a ferromagnetic metal nanoparticle and an insulating nanoparticle. That difference is already clear from the bulk physics. This is a stoner, if you like, model picture schematic of a ferromagnetic metal the energies of majority and minority spins are different. The majority spins are lowered in energy, so they have bigger Fermi surfaces. And so in this kind of picture, you have all of the usual particle hole excitations near both the minority and majority spin Fermi surfaces, and also spin flip transitions, which unlike the excitations that we're, let's say, accustomed to in normal metals, these involve energies that are near the Fermi energy, but they're basically completely uncorrelated in terms of the way they see the disorder potential. So they won't have level repulsions, for example. On the other hand, we know that in a bulk system, in addition to these particle hole excitations, which once you get to a certain wave vector can have vanishing energy, so these are spin flip transitions, spin flip particle hole excitations, and they're also spin wave excitations in the system. And so that means that we have at low energies both particle hole type excitations that are prominent, for example, in the physics of normal metal mesoscopic systems, and we have spin wave excitations. And once we have a system that's finite in size and has a, let's say, random surface, we can no longer use wave vector to separate these two types of excitations as we can in the bulk. So they're both present. And so the game of that we play in, let's say, semiconductor quantum dots or normal metal grains of looking at excitations above a Coulomb blockade peak, this zoo of particle hole excitations that becomes important when you have non-equilibrium effects, as we just heard, for example. In addition to all of that physics, we have spin wave excitations. And so I want to say something about, so that's anyway a part of what I want to talk about. The other part has got to do with hysteresis. So everything that's interesting, let's say, in a magnetic particle occurs in, has to do with magnetic anisotropy, occurs on a magnetic field scale of the anisotropy field, which is extremely small field compared to the field scales that influence the physical properties of normal metal particles. And so the physics I'm interested in here really has to do with how the excitation spectrum of a magnetic particle is changing when you move the particle's magnetic state through a hysteresis loop in an external magnetic field. And so let me just say how, remind you how that is described in these different types of languages. So first example, at least in a very simple model of a magnetic particle, for example, one that has uniaxial, easy axes that up and down, if you like, spin directions have the same energy in the absence of a field, then what happens when you apply a field in this classical description is that if the system is magnetically in this state, it will stay in that state until the field is strong enough to eliminate the local minimum here. And the field at which that happens is the anisotropy field. And of course, the fact that that classical description more or less works perfectly is what makes magnetic information storage possible. And if you look up any book on magnetism, you can find pictures like this that summarize, this is the Stoner-Wolfarth theory, and this describes the evolution of the magnetization with external field for different angles of the field with respect to the easy axis. And maybe one of the things I'll come back to is that this theory never works perfectly. So that's a classical description. And so when we get down to these small particles and we're looking at the quantum excitation spectrum as we go around these hysteresis loops, that's really the property we want to look at. Then we needed some sort of quantum theory, and one possibility, which as I'll say is a little bit too naive for most purposes, is just to add an anisotropy term to some collective quantum spin model of a magnetic particle, for example, something with a large spin. And so when you do that, what happens, let's say, for example, you prepare the system initially in this state. This is really just the field and units of the anisotropy field. And as you change the field in this direction, this classical state, remains stable, as you see quantum mechanically in the very small level crossing gaps here. So this is all the kind of physics that occurs in magnetic molecules, and that we'll be talking about later in the week. But this is not the whole story for a metal, because we have particle hole excitations as well. Okay. So that's the context for what I want to say. Now, I want to discuss what happens quantum mechanically from several different points of view. First, I'm going to discuss the same model that Jan van Delft mentioned in the last talk. It's a very simple model. We just have a bunch of orbitals in the grain and an exchange interaction that's between the orbitals that's independent of which orbitals are involved. So microscopically, this really corresponds to having an exchange interaction between electrons in these different orbitals, which is infinitely long range, extends across the entire grain. And one can say quite a bit about what is correct and not correct about this type of model, but basically there are three reasons for introducing such a model. One, of course, most important one is it's very simple, and also it's easy to generalize, as I'll hopefully mention towards the end, to more realistic models. And thirdly, when we talk about some magnetic particle that, for example, Dan Ralph has created in his laboratory, we don't know enough about it to really do a more detailed model. But there are definitely are some things about this model that are a little pathological that I'll come back to. But still, it's a useful starting point. So let me just talk for a few minutes about the quantum properties of this model. Because it's so simple, because as Lonja Glasman just mentioned, the interaction term is just really total spin squared, we can talk about its properties or without having to use some kind of mean field theory. So, and in fact, it's very easy to understand what the exact spectrum of this model is once we specify these single particle energies. So if I just had the band energy, band term in the Hamiltonian, then states are grouped together, are degenerate, can be basically the energy of a state is specified by saying which orbitals are doubly occupied, which ones are singly occupied, let's say, what in a mean field theory you would say occupied only by majority spins, and which orbitals are empty. And can be a low energy state. And if I have such a state with some number of singly occupied orbitals and I only have the band Hamiltonian, then this state is very degenerate. Basically, all of the states where I occupy any one of these two spin states for that orbital are all degenerate. So the total degeneracy is 2 to the number of singly occupied orbitals. And the interaction term lifts most of that degeneracy, because we add this interaction term, which has to do with the total spin. And so basically it says that for a given configuration of the band states, specifying doubly, singly occupied, and empty orbitals, The energy is lowest when the spin state is as large as spin quantum number is as large as possible. In other words, where all of the singly occupied orbitals have parallel spins. Okay. Maybe I better skip this. So this is just there is this constant interaction model that people have found very useful in getting a qualitative understanding of normal metal systems, how they're seen in these tunneling spectroscopy type experiments. And I won't go through this in detail, I'll just mention a couple of things. So using this simple model, you can easily generalize that to a ferromagnetic particle. The new features that are interesting are that you can tune things, how many extra up or down electrons are occupied now with the Zeeman coupling of a magnetic field to these spins. And also these interaction terms are important, as Jan van Delft mentioned. This is important, for example, in accounting for the fact that when you, for example, add a minority spin to the system, it not only, let's say, causes a smaller change in band energy, but it reduces the exchange energy, and that's very important for how things evolve with field. Okay. So, for this simple model, you can understand a few things. First of all, you can recover basically the mean field picture that the difference between majority and minority spin Fermi energies is something proportional to the interaction to the exchange constant. When the energy is minimized. And another important thing, I'll come back and maybe if I have time add some caveats to this, but for this long-range exchange model, I said that the lowest energy states for a given band configuration have the maximum spin quantum number. And you can ask yourself, well, how much of an excitation energy is there if I make the spin one less than the maximum value, for example, within this multiplet? And if you take this difference, you'll find that the energy difference is comparable to the spin splitting of the bands. And that's a big energy. It's EV. So it basically says in this model that for a given band configuration, I only have to worry about one spin multiplet, that with the one with the maximum spin quantum number, all of the singly occupied orbitals having their spins aligned. And it's the spins of those singly occupied orbitals that constitute the collective magnetization degree of freedom, as I'll start talking about in a moment. And anyway, you can see from this simple model, as I mentioned before, that the up and down particle number response to gate voltage and magnetic field is, they're coupled, for example, as seen experimentally even a few years ago in these experiments by Ono and collaborators, where they were able to tune through Coulomb blockade peaks in a ferromagnetic particle with a magnetic field. Okay, so microscopically, if I can exclude for the moment these magnetic dipole interactions, all of the stuff that's interesting about a magnetic particle, the scale of this anisotropy field, it has to do with spin-orbit interactions. And so let me say something about spin-orbit interactions. What I have in mind here are ferromagnetic transition metal nanoparticles, for example, ones made from cobalt or iron or nickel. And in these ferromagnets, the spin orbit coupling occurs on each atom. It's described by a spin orbit parameter that basically you can take from more or less atomic physics of the d orbitals in these systems. And it turns out that basically because the angular momentum is quenched in a crystal or in any system where I don't have orbital ferromagnetism, there's no first-order shift in the energies due to spin-orbit coupling, and the energy shifts of an individual energy orbital due to spin-orbit coupling are proportional to the square of this spin-orbit coupling constant divided by the bandwidth, and the energy scale of that is a couple of MeV, and that's, for example, the energy shift of an orbital change in the band structure of one of these systems when you add spin orbit coupling. Now this is the origin, and as again, just to simplify, I'm going to forget about magnetic dipole interactions. And so this is the origin of the magnetic anisotropy. And so we might guess that this number, a couple of MeV, is as big as the anisotropy energy per particle can be in one of these systems. In fact, if in a bulk system, if I calculate the anisotropy energy per atom, it's quite a bit smaller than this, at least 20 times smaller. And the reason for that is that this magnetocrystalline anisotropy is the change in these energies not when I introduce the spin orbit coupling, but when I, this formula here is actually for a paramagnetic system. For a ferromagnetic system, this energy shift formula is slightly more complicated, and it depends on the direction of the spins in the singly occupied orbitals. And that's part of the reason that it's smaller. The other reason is that it's not clear, you know, for a given orbital, this comes back to the question that was mentioned in the last talk about about the randomness of in this magnetic anisotropy. It's not clear for if I have, let's say, one orbital, and its energy is lowest when the spins point in the, let's say, 1-1-1 direction. If I have another orbital, the next orbital, maybe its energy is lowest when it points in some other direction. So there tends to be a lot of cancellation between one orbital and another in the anisotropy energy. I mentioned before that when you change the direction, well, as a function of some parameter, it might be that I have crossings between quasiparticle levels of up and down spins without spin orbit coupling. When I have spin orbit coupling, there will never be any crossings, but the size of the avoided crossing gaps can be very, very small, and will tend to be small, become extremely small in large particles, because these orbitals here are spread out over the entire crystal, so it ends up, at least roughly you can estimate, being proportional to 1 over the size of the particle, number of atoms in the particle. And so actually, I'm not sure how much of this I'm going to be able to tell you about, but you can get some, try to develop some intuition about some of these questions by actually calculating the energy bands of a small particle using a tight binding model, for example. For this is some picture of some small cobalt cluster, and when you do these calculations with spin orbit coupling for such a cluster, it's no longer true that you have pure spin up and spin down states. So In the time I have left, I'm going to try and say a few words about the context for the tight binding model calculations like the ones I just showed you. We've been thinking about these ferromagnetic particles using these simple models using an auxiliary field approach. I'll explain in just a second. But basically, it's a very natural approach where if we're interested in being able to simultaneously describe the collective physics of a ferromagnetic particle and the quasi-particle physics. And it's so this is a standard technique in field theory of condensed matter systems, which is particularly simple for this long-range exchange model because the interaction term is just total spin squared, and so I can take this quadratic interaction between the spins and replace it by an integral over an auxiliary field that here is called H, and some of the transparencies that follow, it's called delta, because the meaning of this effective field H here is that this is the spin splitting of the bands. And so in this picture, which is formally exact, what we have is a system that has a fluctuating effective Zeeman field that splits the bands, and the electrons are seeing this fluctuating spin-splitting field. And the dynamics of the, so this H, what is called here H, is the collective behavior, emphasizes the collective aspects of the system, whereas this is basically a one-party Hamiltonian in some effective field. So this represents the single particle aspects. And so if you go through the details of this, as I said, so the particles experiencing some fluctuating magnetic field. And what happens when you do this is that the effective action includes an energy term. This energy as a function of field, this is just basically the only term that's present in the high temperature classical limit. So this is the equivalent for this model of the micromagnetic energy functional. And this term, this Berry phase term, you can see just depends on not on the dynamics of this field, but just on the path it follows as a function of imaginary time. And this, basically, if I take this ddt, then ddt is an energy. So what happens when you go through the details of this is that the coefficient that appears here determines the size, the quantization scale for the energies of energy variation with field. And actually, one remark I forgot to mention earlier, which is very important in talking about the quantum physics of these systems, is that you can see here that this energy, at least in this long-range exchange model, the dependence of total band energy on field, summing over all the occupied orbitals, is extensive, is proportional to the size of the particle. Similarly, the coefficient that appears here, which if you have no spin orbit coupling, ends up just being sum of all the Berry phases of all of the electrons in singly occupied orbitals, is also extensive. So that means that the energy variation with magnetization direction is extensive, but when I take the quotient of these, I find that the quantum unit of collective energy is actually independent of the size of the particle in first approximation. Whereas the quantum energy scale associated with the quasi-particles that's really described by this part, that of course gets big as the particle gets small, proportional to 1 over the volume of the system. So when I go to small particles like the ones we're talking about, this energy scale for collective excitations is actually a smaller scale than the quantization energy of the quasi-particles. And 5 minutes? Okay, I think I'm doing okay. Okay, so if we want to describe the low energy excitations of these systems, we can describe it using a theory where we assume that the collective degrees of freedom only fluctuate a little bit around the direction where they minimize the energy. This is some kind of RPA type theory, which we know actually works quite well for bulk versions of these systems. And so we can develop this as follows. First, we find what was H before is now delta. I call it delta because it's the spin splitting of the bands. But in this formulation, that spin splitting has its own quantum dynamics. But if we want to find the value of the spin splitting that minimizes the total energy, then this is the total energy functional, and including the basically single particle term and the term introduced by the Hubbard-Chertanovich transformation. And the end result of this is simply the usual mean field equation that the spins, you get a self-consistent equation that the splitting of the bands is proportional to the polarization. So this in practice, let's say, the best way we could do this is by doing some sort of local spin density approximation type calculation. And so that you get some sort of self-consistent equation for the spin-polarized magnetic particle. That's the mean field system, and that's totally equivalent to minimizing the energy. What these curves are for these tight binding models I mentioned to you before, this is just calculating the energy as a function of the magnitude of the spin splitting field. The point where it's minimized is the same as the solution to these mean field equations. And this shows how much that curve is altered by spin orbit interactions. And the main point I want to make here is that compared to the total magnetic quantization energy, spin orbit is an extremely small effect. It's only important for the orientation, because it produces an orientation dependence of the magnetic energy. And so if I look, for example, at the dependence of the energy functional around the extremum, concentrating on its, for small fluctuations around the extremum, then the most important, the soft directions for changing the magnetization have to do with changing the direction. So this is a calculation from one of those tight binding models for example, for this particular particle. We don't know how to do this realistically, this is energy as a function of orientation. So one of these curvatures here would be, for example, the curvature here near the minimum. This would be the easy direction for this particular model. So in order to calculate the collective excitation energies, I need to know these. The other term, which determines the sort of the size of the quantization energy unit, comes from these Berry's phases. And the only thing I really have time to say about this is that these Berry's phases are simply proportional to the spin polarization. Or Berry curvatures if there's no spin orbit coupling, but when there is spin orbit coupling, they become highly non-trivial, and that's one of the things we're trying to understand. It's another way to do exactly the same thing, which is just doing perturbation theory. I don't have time to go through this, but let me just mention that if I do this perturbation theory, then I get an energy as This is kernel describes the quadratic fluctuations, quadratic terms in the action. And if I ignore the frequency dependence, that gives me the static energy as a function of orientation that I was talking about from the other point of view before. And the linear term in the expansion of omega, that's the Berry's phase term. And these kinds of equations with those Berry phases, this is basically encodes Landau-Lifshitz equations. And so one of the things I want to mention about this is that it can happen as in the middle of a hysteresis loop that you get some narrowly avoided crossings. And when that happens, I'm talking here about, you know, we're using the language in this talk and the last talk and maybe this morning when we were talking about magnetization reversal about, on the one hand, we have the magnetization, and on the other hand, we have the quasi-particles that carry the current. And of course, underneath, it's all electrons. And what happens when you get actually these level near these level crossings, you can show from this type of analysis that the real elementary excitations of the system are neither collective excitation spin waves, if you like, nor single particle excitations. They're some mixture of the two. Okay, I don't have time to do that. Okay, so let me just conclude with this kind of language, with some of the questions that we're trying to think about, that we think can be probed by future experiments, and that will be, and to some degree, current experiments. The questions are not so well formed, so that allows. So the you can see I don't know what the questions are. That's the only joke. So anyway, let me just try and say what some of these are. So, so using this type of approach, the magnetic anisotropy has to do, as people are actually using this approach somewhat imperfectly to try and understand magnetic anisotropy in bulk transition metal ferromagnets. These anisotropy energy comes from the quasi-particle energies dependence on orientation of the magnetization. This dependence is absent if I have no spin orbit coupling. And this dependence of these energies on orientation of the magnetization is smaller than the actual shift of these energies when you turn on the spin orbit coupling. And so we're trying to understand how much smaller and why. And another thing, this is important to this point is connected with the important question for small magnetic particles about how big is the a bulk system has an anisotropy energy, magnetocrystalline anisotropy energy per unit volume. And when I go to small systems, it will start to fluctuate a lot. Maybe it will change, and I think this is the type of experiment that will be most interesting. If I add one electron to a magnetic particle, as I can in these experiments, then the magnetic anisotropy energy of that particle can change. By how much? When does it change by 1% or by of order 1 for adding a single electron? And so we've been trying to look. So in this picture, the anisotropy energy, as I said, comes from summing up all of the occupied orbitals and finding out how they depend on the orientation of the magnetization. And what we find is we go through the orbitals. For each orbital, there's a typical size of this quasi-particle energy orientation dependence, but it fluctuates a lot. And the fluctuation for a single orbital is much larger than the average value. And it seems like there's a very weak correlation between this orientation dependence for one orbital and an orbital that's nearby in energy. And these are the sort of things that can produce a very substantial, if you like, a mesoscopic fluctuation in the anisotropy energy for adding even for quite large particles. So that's something we're trying to understand better. And connected with this also is the question of trying to what geometry of a cluster will make these magnetic anisotropy barriers as big as possible in a small particle. Now, let me turn to some of the things that I've kind of hidden. We know, as Dan was mentioning this morning, so basically, you know, the excuse for this long-range exchange model, 0 minutes conclude. Okay, I'm working on that. So we know from so basically this long-range exchange model, one of the excuses is that this magnetic stiffness of these particles is big enough that the magnetization will behave coherently inside the entire particle, so we only have to worry about rigid motions of all of the spins, which is basically what comes out of this long-range exchange model. And as Dan mentioned, we know that's not what's going on in the system. In fact, we know the exchange interactions that produce the ferromagnetism are very local there, basically site by site by site. And what's more, it's probably not even true that the magnetic ground state of these systems, let's say in zero field or in some field, is a collinear magnetic state. And it's actually fairly straightforward to generalize the type of model I've been talking about to include those types of effects. There actually is one problem I won't mention. But we don't know enough about the geometry of our we don't always know enough about the geometry of the particles that are being studied to enable a comparison between theory and experiment to be made to see if one's on the right track. So the other final thing we mention is that we're going to hear more about later in the week about collective tunneling of the magnetization between one orientation and another in magnetic molecules, where the physics is actually exceedingly complicated because of physics that's in addition to what's in a simple anisotropic spin model. Here in these magnetic particles, there is additional physics even without phonons or anything else, and that has to do with the quasiparticles. And so this is something we want to try and study using this type of approach. So thanks for listening.
Any questions? The minimum one is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But in quantum in particular,
mm-hmm.
you know that electrons which are responsible for magnetism, which can make electrons which are responsible for conductance, are two different groups of electrons.
Right.
It's a D and S electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, I wouldn't be too serious about numbers, predicting numbers for the energy.
Right, so there is some, I think that, I mean, this sort of, I didn't describe in any detail the model we're using, but it's basically an SD type binding model with the parameters fit to bulk band structures. Okay, so I think it's pretty realistic. I think the thing we have a lot of difficulty with when you talk about magnetic particles is sometimes, depending on how they're prepared, there might be all kinds of ligands on the outside of it, or there might be, we don't know, you know, the lattice constant will change near the surface. So these are the types of effects that may be, in fact, very important in a particular magnetic particle that we have difficulty modeling. But we are trying to do, you know, something that's quasi-realistic in terms of the single particle part of the model.
I have a problem with this maximal spin for a given orbital
mm-hmm.
configuration. Like in an atom it would be fine, because then Kuhn's rule, but for that you need degenerate system. But if I have a chaotic grain with no degenerate orbital, I wouldn't expect to have much spin.
Right, so the difference is that we have the ground state here. So this is, you know, an exact result for this model. So you can't quibble with the result. And I think it's actually fairly generic. And I think the difference compared to what you're thinking is that we're actually looking at states where we have many singly occupied orbitals. Okay? And if we don't include interactions, that creates a huge degeneracy that's partly lifted by interactions and which favors, in a ferromagnet, favors the most spin polarized configuration.
It's uniform change model, forces, is that solvable?
Yeah.
So the reason for doing this to do the mean field.
It's not solvable once you include spin orbit interactions.
Right, but,
yeah.
But then
so that's
by perturbation fields. You start from the exact solution from the S square model and then
In principle, you might be able to, in certain regimes, treat the spin-orbit interactions perturbatively. Starting from this model, it's actually might be a little bit difficult because it's degenerate state perturbation theory because we have this entire spin manifold that's anyway, I don't think even if you could do it, it would give any more insight. Really, the motivation for using this sort of functional integral approach is because we want to make contact with the ideas from classical micromagnetic models of a magnetic particle. So that's the objective of using that approach.
Have you tried to extract from your binding calculations essence to dynamic energy some curve where to a minimum covariant angle?
Mm-hmm.
Did you extract numbers from the
One thing that's interesting is that we do a model. So far we've done this only with this what I was calling long range exchange model, okay? Which means basically we're only looking at coherent variations of the spin orientation, and so what we find is I think the result that you expect for such a model, that the scale of the anisotropy energy is larger than the anisotropy energy, the anisotropy energy per atom is larger in our model clusters than it is in the bulk because of the reduction in symmetry created by the surface. I think what you find in your experiments is something that's actually slightly smaller, if I'm correct. I'm not sure if you remember the numbers, but I think that the numbers you mentioned actually correspond for your particles to an anisotropy energy per atom that is smaller than the bulk value. And I think that the only way that can happen really is that if you have, probably it means you have a non-collinear magnetic ground state, or at least it means that the barrier, the lowest barrier for changing, getting from one configuration to another is not coherent rotation, which I guess is, within classical models is something that is also normally true, but if they're big enough, anyway. These models, we're getting a number that's bigger than what you get in the bulk per atom, and bigger than what you measure.
So what would happen if you would solve the classical model and then quantize its states? It's probably not equivalent.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that would be kind of like... in such a model, you would not be able to have, let's say, the magnetic anisotropy energy fluctuate with particle number. And in fact, the whole anisotropy, I don't think you can get a realistic description of the magnetic anisotropy energy landscape, and also there is this for many properties there's an interplay between what's going on with the quasiparticles and what's going on with the collective excitations, and in fact, as I mentioned at the end, sometimes there's no clear distinction. It's even in this RPA theory, which kind of tries to make a distinction between those things, there isn't one. Yeah, it would be definitely more crude, and I think for some purposes it misses some qualitative physics. Angular dependence of the switching. Oh, okay. You mean on the angle of the field? Yeah. So sure. Even within a simple classical model, even within this Stoner-Wolf model, there is a dependence.
No, I understand.
It won't be a simple cosine. So basically the first answer is, I don't have a very good answer to this question. It's one of the things we're trying to develop a better understanding of. Second answer is, you know, some of the things that happen are, there's lots of fluctuations with particle number, even for quite large grains.
How does the scale of the number? What are the differences from the bulk limit? So this scale is 1 over n, 1 over square root n.
I think in the model we're using, these go up. Let's say, naively, switching field would be independent of particle size, right? In a very simple model with an anisotropy energy per unit volume and a fixed magnetization. In the model I was talking about, it will actually go up. This is the same question I guess they're saying about, since it was the switching field that was used to estimate the size of the anisotropy.
So what will go up again?
Switching? Yeah, in this model it will go up. And in experiment it went down.
It will go up is the size going down.
Mm-hmm.
And which, what is the log? I mean, one over volume or whatever?
No, I don't think so. It would just tend to go up because the surface is reducing the symmetry of the problem. Yeah, so maybe there's some
correction.
Yeah, so you probably the crude estimate you could make is the one you were trying to make at the end of the last talk.
Yeah. One last question and then we'll break and you can ask questions for it.
Different orbitals, you mean?
Well, shape anisotropy and surface anisotropy can point in different.
Yeah. That's possible.
The dipole forces could be on the same order as the crystalline one.
Yeah, depending on the shape of the particle. Yeah. They scale naively in the same way with particle volume, so it's not. Yeah.
I think it's time to break, and let's thank Alan again. Can I thank all the speakers today, Joe?
Let's thank all the speakers, all the chairpersons.